ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Welcome to Speaking Out.
We're mainly discussing land rights and economic empowerment.
Aboriginal enterprises in mining, exploration,
I'd just like
and
energy. To talk a little bit about Indigenous constitutional recognition. Those two.
With Larissa Berendt.
It's a fresh view coming
on ABC Radio.
Sports are a huge part of our community. It's something that we as blackfellas have always excelled at, and it's given us a sense of belonging. While we're in the field, pitch or the court, for those minutes of play, we aren't seen as the other. We're seen as mates. Racism has always been present in our sporting games. Whether it's online, on the field, or just straight up in your face, at the end of the day, when you walk into the locker room, you're still black and must deal with the inevitable racism coming your way. It's not about how it happens, but when it happens. But what if it could all stop and you could turn the tap off? I'm Janae Gibbs-Muir and this is Speaking Out. Today, we discuss with experts, athletes and reporters the recent ABC documentary Endgame. It explores solutions to one of the biggest problems in sport, racism. In Australia, sport is part of our national identity. And even more so, sport has always been what uplifts our communities as First Nations peoples. We've produced some of the most talented players across the codes. Think of Michael Long, Yvonne Goolagong, Artie Beetson, Kathy Freeman. All these legends are shining examples of black excellence. But does that all come at a cost? Each of these big names I've just mentioned at some point had to endure a different form of racial abuse. And today, it's only gotten worse with the use of social media. So what are the solutions to this problem, and how can athletes be at the forefront of it? To kick off, I had a chat with the host of Endgame, Barrabinya Gamilaroi man Tony Armstrong, about how he felt exploring such a tough and personal subject.
I was pretty nervous, you know. It's not an easy thing to talk about, and particularly my experience hasn't been necessarily the easiest one when I do talk about race, I guess, publicly. So, yeah, it was. I was quite nervous, I've got to say. But then, I guess the experience was exactly how you'd probably imagine it being. It was equal parts heavy and equal parts rewarding.
Throughout the doco and in interviews, I've seen you talk a lot about racism fatigue. Do you want to explain what that is and what your experience has been with it?
I guess it's just a term. I might not be the first person to have come up with that term, but it's a term that was an original thought to me, and it was just around sort of this idea that Australians in particular are sick of hearing the problem. They want a solution to come along with it. So they want to hear what can be done because, yeah, I suppose there are a lot of people who don't like being told that we're in a racist country. Things that have happened here have been quite bad, and a lot of people profiteer off the back of that. So, I think heading in with a solutions-based mindset was a very important part of it.
Now, seeing the doco go to air for the last couple of weeks and getting to do interviews, what has people's, like the general public's reaction been to actually seeing solutions out there for this problem?
It's been great. Yeah, I've been so surprised, to be honest. I'm quite cynical when it comes to all this stuff, but I've been pleasantly surprised. And, you know, the feedback to the show, the job that everyone did has been amazing. And that's in no small part down to whoever was in the editing room looking at my face.
Yeah.
for the best part of I don't know how long. So, like, they just did a great job, I guess is what I'm trying to say, you know. from director to producers to the ABC's help and, yeah, everyone in between. And because of that, the reaction's been really, really positive. And hopefully, you know, we can see some stuff come out of it, which would be great.
After going in the first episode, you got to go over to the UK and see these solutions in action. What was your initial reaction? And after talking to the big sporting codes, do you think they would implement that over here?
Well, look, we've had some encouraging first conversations with them. Sport here is so agnostic, and I think what lies underneath it all is the fact that they really acknowledge that they've got a problem over there, and I think it's so Australian to not, and that comes down to, like, you know, how you're feeling. Good, yeah. Thanks. Like we'll even lie about that. So in our day to day, like, everything's always got to be seen to be going fine. So it's so ingrained in us not to sort of talk straight at it or talk right about stuff. So yeah, I think that's a bit of the difference. And I think once we can kind of do that properly, then I think we'll start seeing some meaningful change. Yeah.
Where do you think these conversations about this problem starts? Is it with the players or the leadership in the end?
Well, I think there's no silver bullet, right? To lump it all on one group is not fair, I don't think.
Yeah.
I do think leadership plays a huge role in setting the tone and creating an environment where everyone can speak freely and feel supported. But then I think it's on players to have the tools to be able to speak to it as well, you know, because so much can get lost in translation. I think we've all been in a situation where we've probably let something get away from us because we haven't had the ability to articulate it right. And then also, you know, in empowering fans, not just to call each other out, but to do better. I think creating safe environments is key.
And seeing what was happening over in America with the Players Coalition, do you think that could be something that could work over here in Australia?
Well, we're trying to set one up.
Yep.
So, yes, it's just such a dormant power that exists in Australia in terms of having this over-indexed trust in sports people. And it's not being used as well as it could be, I don't think, to advocate. And so with that in mind, I think, yeah, it'd play a really good role. Of course, you get the keep politics out of sport crowd, but they're the ones who want to deny the human existence of sports people. They just want to see them purely as sports people, or as people who play sport and not as people.
And
I think those people suck.
Yeah, exactly. And also, like, because I do think that with the women's game as well, we see a lot of activism, even like in AFLW or in NRLW. Could we learn off them and how they do it and kind of take a lesson from their book?
The best example of changing narratives in my mind has been the Matildas. The way that they captured the heart of a nation off the back of continuing to be exactly who they were, and still are, I should say, was incredible. And of course, AFLW, the netballers are amazing. The NRLW, like, all of these sports, I think the women's competitions seems to be able to galvanize much better.
And just last question, what do you think people, most importantly sports organisations, will take from this doco after watching it? Or what do you hope for?
There are solutions. There are solutions. You've just got to be brave enough to be the ones to do it. And then once you do it, you'll realise that everyone has been waiting for someone to do it, and we'll likely see everyone fall in line.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, you know, it just takes the people to stick their neck out and be the ones.
You're listening to Speaking Out, and this week I'm your host, Janae Gibbs-Muir. I've been talking with Tony Armstrong about his recent doco, Endgame. And it made me realise that this issue can have a serious impact on a player's career. It can define who they are in the eyes of fans and organisations, giving you the reputation of being a troublemaker. The great Adam Goodes won the Brownlow Medal twice and was at the peak of his playing career when he was racially abused by a fan. Since then, he's been upfront about his complicated relationship with the sport he once loved.
We have a real issue in this country talking about racism. You know, I'd been playing for 16 years when the booing started. I totally felt I wasn't getting any respect for the way I was verbalising my situation, how everything was happening. Mm. So sometimes you can say and do all the right things and it still doesn't work. For me, once I retired from football, I knew personally that my role was taking a back seat.
Colin Kaepernick, a quarterback for the San Francisco 49ers, made headlines across the world in 2016 after he took the knee during the national anthem to call out police brutality and racial inequality. He was stood down by the league and since then has not played for any NFL team since.
He's very outspoken about all of these unarmed black people getting shot by police and decides not to stand for the national anthem. Here's a popular player who has the nerve to do this.
I mean, ultimately, it's to bring awareness and make people, you know, realize what's really going on in this country. There's people being murdered unjustly and not being held accountable. Cops are getting paid leave for killing people.
And especially in this country where the flag is the symbol of the pride of a nation that ignited a firestorm. The conversation was not why he did it. It was the nerve of him not standing for the national anthem.
Throughout the doco, we hear this idea of athletes using their platforms to advocate for inclusion in sport. However, we've seen major consequences for players who choose to use their voice. So how do we protect players and give them support when they choose to speak out against racism? Olympian and Kanju man Patrick Johnson is a culture and safety advisor with Sport Integrity Australia. Part of his job is to inform the sporting community on how they can be more inclusive. Patrick is also the chair of the 2032 Brisbane Olympic Committee. In the lead up to the Brizzy Olympics, he wants to encourage athletes to use their voices as much as possible. However, if athletes do want to speak out, codes need to be able to back them.
Something that we've committed to not only through winning the bid to host another Olympic Games, home Olympic Games, of course, Brisbane Olympic and Paralympic Games. So there's a real opportunity now, but it's also a commitment from, you know, what we promised to why we won the bid is to ensure that the games and sport is actually more extension around the social impact. So there will be that happening, not only in Brisbane and, you know, Gold Coast and Sunshine Coast, but regional Queensland, but the whole of Australia. I think that's really important that Australia sees this is the games for them. And it's also a games for the Oceania. So there's a real opportunity that we need to actually share and celebrate not only, you know, the Brisbane games itself, where the majority of the events will be, but the whole country and the region and the complexities, but also the celebration of our cultural diversity. We need to be able to celebrate that and showcase that to the world because the world's going to be looking at us, and they already are, but LA is going to hand the baton to us and the torch to us in 3 years' time after the LA Olympic Games.
Yep.
So the world's going to be looking at us. So we have an incredible opportunity to shape and shift that in a way that really not only elevates what we might have seen in 2000 Olympics, but it's going to be tenfold leading into Brisbane 2032 and the legacy of Brisbane 2032 Olympic and Paralympic Games.
In terms of talking about how athletes use their platforms, what role do you think athletes have to play in advocacy, particularly here in Australia?
Oh, it's really important to have those athletes because they're seen as role models and they're in the spotlight. But it's also we need to make sure we support them and protect them as well because we need to have those advocacy, not only the athletes, but I'm a big believer that we all have to be the advocates. We all need to lead by example and we all need to call out what's maybe seen as plain in front of us that it's, you know, unacceptable behaviour. So it's not only to the athletes, but I think athletes have an incredible platform, of course, to be able to do that, but it also comes at a cost. Mm. So we need to make sure they're protected, they're supported, but also they're not just the sole voice in the room calling out something. I think you have athletes calling out something, but it has to be backed by the sports, the CEOs, the sponsors, the fans, the families and the governments. And everyone's got to be part of this conversation. I think what I've seen previously that, you know, in good attempt, we're not actually working collaboratively together. So there's a real opportunity to shift that, to say, look, let's have a real conversation. And the athlete's voice is calling out what we police know and see, but we need to be better in what we do to tackle these major issues in sport, because we want sport to be more inclusive, more safe and protected. And particularly around, you know, myself and our role in sport integrity is to actually look at the threats to sport. Mm. And we need to work with the system and collaborative to all the stakeholders in the space to really create a real shift and change. It's not just up to us. It's everyone's opportunity to really be part of the conversation for real change that real makes a real difference for now and for our next generations.
And should we also be looking at all like bigger organisations like AFL or NRL, for example, and their role they have in supporting these players when they do speak out?
Oh, definitely. And I think that it's AFL and NRL and some other major codes in basketball, they are doing some of that calling out and supporting athletes. I think it's just how we actually continue to have that conversation and also make sure that we are really, really not just calling out for one moment. It's an ongoing education. It's ongoing opportunity that we are shifting the culture that, and I'm big on cultural integrity. So it's a holistic approach. Mm-hmm. We can't just pick and choose when we decide what is an integrity and what we need to take in. It actually has to be something that's fundamentally human as well, because I think policies and procedures are really great because it has to be fit for purpose. Mm-hmm. But we need everyone to be part of the conversation. I think, you know, the major codes, as you know, they have an incredible opportunity and a leadership role given their clientele and the majority of, you know, how many people follow their sports, right?
Yeah.
They have an incredible opportunity to take the leadership role, but also take the leadership role with everyone else in that space to be contributing and part of the conversation. So therefore, the leadership from all levels is understood and the clear line in the sand that we have zero tolerance around this, and we will ensure that our players, our staff, our fans, our sponsors, and everyone involved in sport feels safe, feels connected, is inclusive, and is protected at all levels of what we believe is sport is a great unifier.
How do we make sure that people who participate within sport are connected, and how do we educate those who may not know much about these issues?
Yeah, well, I think there's a key point here is, you know, be proactive in getting educated and creating awareness and having that conversation. I think probably in a lot of ways we're not having a real conversation around what we want to see. So if your son or your daughter or you follow a sport, what are you doing to have that conversation around what's the culture we want for this sport? Mm. Has it a zero tolerance? Is it making sure there's unacceptable behaviour? If it happens, what are we doing to it? So I think there's sometimes like, oh, somebody else is going to deal with the issue.
Yeah.
I think there's a real opportunity that, you know, if you're a parent, if you're a sponsor, you're a player, you're a fan, or you're a major corporation, what, or government, we all need to have a conversation around what we are doing. Mm. And I think we have to have an honest conversation. What's working? What can we improve on? And how do we continue to improve so that when you come to a sporting event, regardless from grassroots to high performance, there's a set standard. And I think at the moment, I think the standard is set depending on where you are, who's driving the leadership. So maybe let's switch that a bit and say, well, everyone has an opportunity to set the standard. What are we all individually going to do to have that set the standard? And one has been educated, of course, creating more awareness, but then having that conversation with other parents, with other board directors, other sponsors, other players around, well, what's this look like? Because a lot of times when you're raising major concerns or issues around sport, most people are not even aware of what the threat or the issues is because they haven't been introduced to it or not even aware of it, or it hasn't even come across their educational awareness. So education awareness is one step, but the next step is having a real conversation around what that is And then you look at the solutions around how you're going to deal with this so everyone feels safe, protected, and it's not seen as a reactive, it's actually a proactive approach that we all need to take.
That was Olympian, Cultural Advisor to Sport Integrity Australia and Chair of the 2032 Olympic Committee, Patrick Johnson. You're listening to Speaking Out with me, Janae Gibbs-Muir. Patrick Johnson gave us an insight into how a players' coalition would work here in Australia. As mentioned by Tony earlier on the show, it would mean players from different codes coming together and advocating to legislate laws that protect players from being discriminated against. It would also ensure that the next generation of talented young mob would be protected from any form of racial abuse. But for players to be incentivized to speak out against racism, they need their clubs to support them. Sporting organisations need to be part of the solution. We've seen in the US, the National Players Coalition involves over 1,400 players from across the various playing codes. It took a while for players to get on board with the idea, but once they did, real change started to happen.
We really are trying to use athletes' platform to impact systemic change. What the athletes have and what sports does is create a platform where people are listening. So when we can see that there's a law that could impact people in a positive way in the community and we can rally those players around that, that's where change really happens. You know, Players Coalition to date has helped pass 30 pieces of legislation across the country in criminal justice reform, economic advancement, and education.
When we get down to the nuts and bolts, how would a process work?
When a player comes to us and say, hey, this particular issue is important to us, we grab subject matter experts and we build out a campaign timeline and we'll say, here are the few key things that you can do to now impact that piece of legislation.
Patrick Johnson says that organizations need to start reflecting on their own histories and that First Nations people are represented and supported at all levels.
It shouldn't be just them calling it out.
Mm.
It should be, everyone around that room, how powerful would it be if, you're in a stand and then a few people were abusive and saying, unacceptable behaviour, You had half that stand standing up and saying, no, we don't stand for this, right?
Yep.
So therefore, that individual that might be going, oh, well, I'm just joking, they might go, hang on, I've actually got to rethink what I'm saying because I didn't think I was racist, I didn't think I was sexist or homophobe, whatever it is, right?
Mm.
But I've been called out by everyone. And it's not it's not like, hey, mate, you need to pull your head in. I mean, there's a simple thing that, if the half the stand that believe that we should not have this behaviour because we've got kids in the sand, right?
Yep.
That half that side of that stadium might stand up and go, if you keep doing it, like that might be just a silent, we don't tolerate it, right? I'm just giving an example, right?
Yeah, yeah. Mm.
But a lot of times it's on the athlete and then the athlete itself is then ostracized because they call it out.
Mm.
So why are they seen as the person that, is called something out that has affected them? Teammates, sponsors, coaches, fans, everyone should be going, hang on, we don't accept this because we've come here to watch sport.
Yep.
And we want people to perform at their best. And I think we talk about passion, which is fine, but you don't have to go to those levels of abusing somebody from race, color, creed, whatever it is, religion. We should be able to just enjoy a game and celebrate that. And I think we've got to remember that what we say, people hear, and if you have kids that are in the stand, they think then that's a normal thing we need to be doing, which is not. We all know that what's right and wrong, to be honest. So we need to have that clarity that, it's not just the players calling it, it's everyone, right?
Yeah.
Now, how powerful would that be? Not only the players, from the fans, from, the key leaders of the sports themselves, from the sponsorship, everyone say, hang on, guess what? What you said is inappropriate. We need to call that out, but also we need to make sure you're aware what's happening.
Mm.
Of course, you need to get educated, you need to get awareness, but what happens? You're seen as, well, you don't want to go in the corner and get some education and you have not learned anything new from that, right? So there's a real opportunity to shift and change how we have a conversation and how we call this out, because usually it's just up to the athlete to take the brunt of it, because they've been affected, and then they're even in the worst position because it's all about them, but it should be all about them and protecting them and safeguarding our athletes, because that's an extension of your club and your sport and your community and the broader representation of what you're trying to encourage and attract to be a part of your sport. Because if your sport is not, you know, standing up to this, you know, you might not getting the right people in your space, or you may lose people.
Seeing all the solutions being shown in Endgame across the world, do you think we could that could work here in Australia? And should we start implementing stuff like Signify to stop online abuse as well?
Oh, I think there's great opportunities to see what's happening overseas, which I think the Endgame has. But I think also we've got an opportunity to look what's actually happening in Australia too.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, it's great we look overseas, but I think we also make sure, because we probably haven't really got a bit of a deeper dive what actually works in Australia and what is working.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of things happening in communities or different organisations doing different things. So I think there's an opportunity to just really look, make sure what's happening internationally, what's happening locally. Can we have a hybrid of that? Because, as you know, some things that happen in America or England or UK or somewhere may not really be fit for purpose for Australia, right?
Yeah.
We're very unique in that sense. But there might be elements of that we can utilise. But I think in a lot of ways we're very unique in Australia around that, and I think there's a real opportunity to shape, you know, the solutions and the realities of what we see overseas to be fit for purpose for Australia's context. And to make sure then that evidence and data and the support for athletes, for coaches, whatever it is for clubs and sporting or grassroots,
mm-hmm.
actually is fit for purpose for our communities, which is really important. And we need to make sure our communities are involved in the design and in the conversation. So if you're not actually talking to Multicultural Australia or diverse communities around what this is, then you've actually dismissed the whole point of the work, right?
Yeah.
Or First Nations communities. So there's a real opportunity. I think we need to be, you know, not just, you know, I'm a big believer that it has to be a measured approach to this.
Mm.
This is not something that's come up new around racism or discrimination or racial discrimination in sport. This has been around for a long time. So let's make sure that when we step into a opportunity to create change, we bring everyone on the same journey.
Yeah.
So everyone then understands there's a certain set standard that we're creating here, and there's a line in the sand that we will not tolerate. There's no grey areas around racism, right,
mm-hmm.
and racial discrimination. And I think that's where, from my point of view and from Sport Integrity's point of view, that's a clear no grey area, right?
Yeah.
There's a clear line in the sand. So let's talk about what we're doing, what's not working, how do we improve it, get everyone involved, but be part of the conversation. And it is tough because you're going to have difficult conversations.
Should we be pushing more for our organisations to have more diversity within their leadership cohorts so that we can see more change in the future?
Oh, definitely. I think you need the right representation, I think, and you need more than just one voice. I think that's really important because you need a combination of voices that support those individuals in leadership role.
Yeah.
And it's also those leaders in those roles need to be able to listen to the voices of, you know, the players, the everyone. So it has to be a holistic approach. And I think that's probably the success of what can happen when you have the right people in the room to have the right conversation.
Yeah.
There's more than one person. But I think that one person, as you know, is really important for the shift and change of sport.
Yeah.
Because the representation is really just a crucial component. But individuals in different roles do get that cultural overload. They do get, you know, a lot of pressure. So how do we actually support them? But also make sure the people that are providing that advice are being heard. So there's a bit of a balance there that needs to happen. But I think more representation, of course, that is ideal because it's not just one voice. It's many voices talking, but it's also those individuals that on the board as well being fully aware what we're actually talking about and why we're actually doing this.
Back in August on Speaking Out, host Larissa Berendt had a heartfelt conversation with Tanya Hosh. Tanya was the first Indigenous person and the second only woman to serve in the executive ranks of the AFL. Her work and support for Adam Goods after he was racially abused on the field in 2013 led to her securing an apology from the AFL 6 years later. Here, she describes her experience working in her role as Executive General Manager of Inclusion and Social Policy.
Look, I think, you know, for the AFL, this is a game that has prospered on the talent and skills and passion of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander players on the field. A lot of people think the game wouldn't be what it is without those particular contributions because the immense talent that we see on field is some of the most exciting footy you'll ever see. And it's one of the reasons that I fell in love with football growing up in Adelaide because it was the only time I ever saw blackfellas cheered for. And I, you know, I took away something from that. People often like to say that sport and politics shouldn't mix, but anyone that's involved with sport knows that sport is full of politics and it is a social activity. And when you're bringing people together from different walks of life, you must be able to respond to where all those people are and where they're coming from, and the fact that they bring with them, you know, attitudes and thoughts and views. When you're a sporting code as big as ours, one in every 21 Australians is a paid member of an AFL football club, which is enormous representation across the country. So that means we've got enormous reach. And we've got some responsibility and, you know, we've got a number of, you know, a good proportion, usually within our men's game, at least 10 or 11% of our players are Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander, and currently in the women's game it's about 5%. We've got a responsibility as a sporting code to make sure that we are not overlooking the views, aspirations and equality of Australia's First Peoples. It's as simple as that. But we also say that we're a game for everyone. And so in my role, it is to really try and make sure that that is the case, whether it be a non-binary or transgender person who wants to play our game, whether it's someone with a disability that wants to be able to access our game or play the game, whether it's ensuring that we've got much better representation in the leadership and governance of the game. All of that participation counts and all of those things are important. And I don't find it hard to be passionate about working in Aussie rules football. It's been 7 years now. I love it. I love the game. But with the privilege and the access comes responsibility, and I guess it's my job to keep that on the agenda. And, you know, I like to think that sport can play a really positive role in helping reach a lot of Australians who might not be involved in conversations like the Voice to Parliament through any other way.
After hearing about all the solutions from today, I decided to have a conversation with someone who's been behind the scenes through it all. Chris Flanders is a First Nations reporter who has worked for over a decade, working on some of the biggest sporting moments in our community, while at NITV and the Courier Mail. I wanted to get his insights into where he thinks we'll go next and how Endgame could have a major impact on changing the attitudes around racism in sport.
I started at NITV being the sports presenter slash reporter in sort of late 2010 till probably 2019. And while I absolutely loved it because it was, you know, I'm a big sports fan myself, so to be able to do that on a daily basis and I guess have the opportunity to speak to a lot of our talented, you know, Indigenous sportsmen and women was, you know, a bit of a dream sort of come true for me in terms of my career and just, you know, what I'd been doing in media. You know, I started in 96 before then, so, but to actually do, yeah, sport was pretty incredible. I guess, you know, some of the challenges was sometimes not being taken, I guess, seriously. you know, you would go to, you know, media press releases, and you know, you'd have the media scrums there, and you know, obviously your Foxtels and your Channel 7s and 9s and 10s and things like that. You sort of, and I was a VJ at that time too, so I was, you know, cameraman / audio / you know, journalist. So it was just me by myself having to set things up, and that takes a little bit of time too, whereas a lot of, you know, crews were already set and to go. But I think just, being taken seriously, you know, by being there amongst all these other sort of sporting, you know, media people.
Yep.
And just sort of, you know, hey, you know, I'm here for my job too. I've got to speak to this person, and this is what I need. So, but also, I guess, having to deal with sometimes media managers and things like that too, which was a little bit tough again too. You wouldn't get a direct response straight away, and you know, it almost as if you were, you know, pleading and begging. It's like, you know, hey, can you speak to the black media, please? But you know, they're Indigenous stars.
Mm-hmm.
That's who we wanted to speak to. So it wasn't like I was asking for something that was completely, you know, out of the way or, you know, hard for them to fix up. So it was challenges like that, I think, you know, just sort of being taken seriously initially, which I guess was, you know, some of those hurdles, you know, at the start. And, you know, hopefully it's a lot different now for our black media, you know, going out and doing things. And I always just made sure that, you know, my NITV mic in the middle, and always made sure that, you know, I got my questions through, or made sure that, you know, I needed to do what I was there to do.
Because I kind of found it like pretty daunting when I first started going out and like having to talk to Indigenous sports players. I think one of my first interviews was Jesse Ramian, and he was just probably one of the nicest people to talk to. But like, did you ever kind of feel like, because you're Indigenous yourself, you had already had that sense of connection with the players, and that kind of helped a bit more?
Yeah, most definitely. Like I said, when you got away from the media managers and you just had the contact with the actual, you know, sports stars themselves, like, you know, your brothers and your sisters there, well, that's what it felt like, you know. And I think they actually appreciated seeing a black face to look out to in, you know, to receive questions from, or
for sure,
or to actually, have a sit down interview, or you know, actually have something planned where, you know, there was a, you know, a black sports presenter, reporter standing on the other side and asking, you know, questions that were relevant to them as well, you know, particularly around, you know, things like, you know, your mob and, you know, where you're from and things like that. And you did feel that connection sort of straight away. I always remember going out to Sydney Swans training sessions, and they were always actually really good to deal with their media. But, you know, going to when they were just sort of lumped in one sort of big press, you know, scrum, it was great, because I remember, you know, Adam Goods, you know, the amazing, you know, footballer for the Swans, and, you know, captain and everything, that he would, you know, often sort of, you know, put his hand up and just sort of, you know, acknowledge that I was sort of there. Hey, brother, how you going? And stuff like that. And that, you know, made me feel really good as well.
Yeah, for sure.
And that he, you know, acknowledged that, oh, yeah, look, we got black media here too.
And I feel like we also bring a unique perspective to the stories as well from our own lived experience. What were some of the stories you got to work on over the years that kind of like stuck with you in terms of dealing with the issue of race in sport?
Well, I guess when I started, and before I'd sort of took on the actual sports presenter sort of role at NITV later on, as I said, I've been working in black media since 96, and, you know, through you know, ICAM, and then, you know, Living Black and things like that. So when I was, I think my very first few stories, particularly the sports stories, were with people like, you know, Nicky Winmar.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think that would have been around 97, 98. So, you know, the incident from, you know, that famous incident, you know, where, you know, he lifted the jumper up and pointed to his skin and said, yeah, you know, I'm black and I'm proud sort of thing, was only a few years old by the time I actually got to speak to him. So I remember seeing that on the news as a teen, you know, as a, you know, young fella, and going, oh, wow, look at this, what this fella's doing sort of thing, you know. And I was here growing up living in New South Wales, so, you know, it was at that time, still the AFL really wasn't a huge, massive sport. Yes, we did have Sydney here, but it wasn't a huge, sport in New South Wales at the time. But I remember, what he was doing, and I thought, wow, this fella's, making a stance. So I was very fortunate enough to then, as I say, 97, 98, a few years after that had happened, to speak to Nikki down at, Moorabbin Oval, the old St Kilda football ground down there in Melbourne. Mm-hmm. And, he was honestly one of the loveliest people I've met. Really good guy and, very open and spoke, about what happened. And I guess, for myself, I tried to make sure that I knew as much as I could about what happened, but it was almost like an education too for me that day as well. Yeah, like, he explained sort of, what happened and, about the, how you could actually hear, the racial abuse, coming to him from, the stands at Collingwood's, Victoria Park that day.
Yeah.
And, how it affected him and, but in the game, obviously him and, he absolutely killed it. He had an amazing a game, and Gilbert McAdam too. Of course, was he was he was there that day, and he obviously could hear these taunts, and then they were directed at him as well, and anything to try and get at these amazing black athletes who were doing really well.
Yeah.
So that was probably my first real sort of, I guess, venture into racism in sport. Like, it wasn't just a sports story, and I knew that it, and I was, obviously my producers, back at the time, and I was fairly young, teen, sort of making my way through media, and they said, make sure, you definitely have to speak to Nikki about this. And and he was wonderful in his approach and what he gave me that day. And very fortunate enough that was one of the biggest sort of sports stars I got to speak to starting off.
I just finished uni, and that was the year the story came out of my own uncle, Robbie Muir, who played for St Kilda, and him telling his story about his experiences with racism and how St Kilda didn't really support him. So it's like, it's not good that they go through this, but it's good we know about it in a way so that we can change. But has anything really changed with AFL, at least within these club cultures?
What support did, Michael and Nikki have around them, and, other, players, from that era have around them? Who did they go to? Who did they speak to?
Yeah.
And that would have been so difficult, because the only support network they would have had would have been, their family and, close friends.
Yeah.
And there would have been that old, what happens on the field stays on the field sort of, line, drilled out, I'm sure, because that's how it was. Mm. And you couldn't speak up, really. You couldn't, go forward and say, hey, look, this has happened to me. Yeah, you do often wonder sort of how far we've come. Mm. As I say, I don't think it sort of happens with the players. I think the players now, there seems to be a lot more camaraderie and sort of respect around and to, Indigenous players that, they share the field with. Mm. And some of them, our Indigenous mob, of course, are some of the biggest stars in the game. So they get around them now, I think, a lot more, like in terms of the players and, possibly the clubs as well, now a bit more educated about what to do and sort of, what we need to put in place. There's still a long way to go, of course. I think, with the particularly when you look at some of the drop-off in numbers with the AFL, with the Indigenous mob, and, where does that come from? How do you look at that and go, well, what's the game doing wrong? Why aren't our mob coming through, the national draft? Like, the draft numbers too were, from 10 years ago, where that was like 17 in 2025, 2015 to now 2025, there was just four this year.
Oh, wow.
So it's a significant drop from 17 to four.
Yeah.
And that's the place where, some of these young fellas will come through to get selected for their first taste.
Yeah, and I feel like with the All-Stars game, like in the NRL particularly, it's actually started a lot more conversation around like what's happening with the Maori community in New Zealand as well. And like players are getting educated from both sides of the coin, like, and it's started to connect that relationship a bit more.
Yeah, most definitely. And, you know, when the NRL Indigenous round first started, you know, obviously, you know, Preston Campbell there, the wonderful Gold Coast and Penrith Cronulla player, he wanted to do something. And it was really sort of, you know, generated off the back of an idea from the late, great Artie Beetson as well, to have, you know, our mob come together, all our great footballers, and play the best of the rest, so to speak. So initially those games were just against, you know, the NRL. And then later on, as the sort of interest in the game started to slip a little bit too. And you could see that in the, you know, in the crowd numbers and things like that. But and just the when it went from, okay, the NRL All-Stars and the interest was waning to then let's play the Maori All-Stars.
Yeah.
And that has given the game such a huge shot.
Now,
and you've got, you know, these the passionate Maori mob, you know, in the stands and the supporters, they love their football just like our mob do.
Yeah.
You know, they've got, you know, their colours and their flags and, you know, obviously that amazing, you know, that, you know, they got the haka and the response from the Indigenous boys with their dance and the women too. You know, it's been such a great thing to see that passion and the cultures, you know, coming together. You know, they've even taken a game overseas to New Zealand.
Yep.
And, you know, because they know the importance of it too, you know, that this is an inspiring, you know, young mob, you know, in, across, you know, the Tasman there to play football, but also know that, you know, you can do, you know, whatever you want to do sort of thing too.
Yeah.
But now that this game has been succeeding so well,
yep,
it's now sort of competing with, you know, the Las Vegas game, you know, because the All-Stars is in early February.
Yeah.
So it's like, you know, players, you know, actually, you know, what are they – yeah, there's a decision there now.
We just had knockout season. We had like the Koori knockout and we had the Vic Carnival and WA Carnival. It's usually a time where our players get to like interact with community and they get to go back home. There was also a discussion of them not being allowed possibly next year to play these big like cultural tournaments, basically. What are your feelings around that and how do you think that will affect players in our games?
Well, again, you know what it means to the players.
Mm.
They want to go back home and, you know, play for their you know, their mob and their family, you know, where they're from.
Yeah, yeah.
And it means a lot to them to get out there and pull on that jersey and be part of that team, you know. And we've seen so many, you know, NRL players in the past who have been able to do that. And and what it means to, you know, connect, you know, with the other players and the team and what they bring to the competition as well. That brings in more fans. I mean, the Koori knockout's always going to get people going.
Mm.
But, you know, the fact that, you know, a little kid might walk past, you know, Jesse Ramian, as you said, or, you know, walk past, you know, Latrell or, you know, that's massive.
Yeah, for sure.
A lot of these, you know, the mob from, you know, wherever they're coming from. And you've obviously the Koori knockout, that's a statewide competition. So, you know, you're getting teams from, you know, back of Burke and, you know, you're getting teams from, you know, the, up and down the coastlines and everywhere in between. You know, a lot of their mob don't get to see, you know, people like Latrell Mitchell only on TV.
Yeah.
But here they could, you know, they can rub shoulders with the lad.
In these big games and events that we're talking about, we can also talk about our Indigenous players, like they also have an extra responsibility and cultural load on the field as well, because they're representing like not just themselves, but their mob and their communities. Are we putting too much pressure on them to speak out when it comes to these big issues with racism in sport?
Yeah, I don't think the onus should just be on the player.
Mm.
They've got to be backed by the club 100%. And it can't just be solely on one person.
Gosh, no.
It's too much of a burden to carry, particularly if it's, you know, some of these, you know, racist trolling and the depths that they, you know, go to have a, you know, to, you know, spew all this racist vitriol to them.
Mm.
It's just, you know, that's too much for one person to take on and carry. And that then a lot of times, a lot of this rubbish gets directed at their family and you know, their partners. You know, that's absolutely, it's disgraceful
that even happens. Yeah, and we saw the effect of it with Callum Archie in Endgame when he was talking about how his partner was upset because he was experiencing all this online abuse. How do we protect our players so that they're not hesitant to speak out on these issues?
I think they need to be able to know that they can 100% go to whoever it is in their club and say, look, this has happened. You know, I want to do something about that. Or, you know, the club, you know, needs to go, this has happened to you. This is what we're going to do. So we're going to get on the front foot.
Yeah.
And we're going to, you know, have a press release. We're going to have a, you know, media, we're going to invite, and you know, we're going to get on the front foot and go, this is what's happened to our player. This is not on, it's unacceptable. And I think that way too, a lot of the players may be sort of more inclined to perhaps you know, approach the clubs or, you know, sort of speak up a little more about it. I mean, some do. We've seen that in the AFL with some, you know, particularly for some young players too, to do that. And it's something that, you know, a young teenage kid who's, you know, trying to play football shouldn't have to encounter, let alone sort of deal with that in their mind, you know, their mental health and well-being.
Yeah.
And to then go, okay, well, I'm going to stand up and be the face of this, you know, whilst I'm still copying it left, right and centre from, you know, these, you know, keyboard warriors and, and such.
Sport is like one of the things in Australia that gets you to start a conversation. So I think it really is ingrained as us as Australians, and like it can be a vehicle for change. Do you reckon it could be like a new era of like truth telling?
Yeah, look, it has the power to be. That's for sure. You know, sport does have that capacity and that ability to sort of bring people together, but also, you know, raise sort of, you know, issues in those sports as well. And you know, hopefully find solutions. But, you know, we've got so many players from you know, Indigenous background playing in these sports, you know, right across the country in all the different codes who are just some of the biggest names in that sport. And there's that old saying too about politics and sport not mixing. Well, I get that too at the same time, but it's like, you know, hang on a tick. It's, you can't have people out there who are standing up for themselves and then, you know, get belted for standing up for who they are and their beliefs. You know, it can go side by side, I think, too, in a lot of cases. I think having, like, particularly going back to what Tony was saying too about politics and sport, he said, well, if you throw that line out, it's sort of taking away that person's beliefs as well.
Endgame uses sport to talk about an issue that isn't just present on the field. Racism and discrimination are a problem in all parts of society, particularly in Australia. But if we can leverage it to start real conversations around this issue, maybe it's the turning point we need to be seen as equal. The onus is not on the players themselves to stamp out racism, but is a whole organisation's responsibility. That's the show for this week. Join us again next time for more stories from across Indigenous Australia. Speaking Out is produced by Nadine Haynes, and our senior producer is Jay McAllister. Some of today's audio was supplied by ABC Indigenous and originally aired on Endgame. You can catch all three episodes on ABC iView. And as always, you'll find Speaking Out on the ABC Listen app or on social media via ABC Indigenous, along with our Titter show, Away, hosted by Rudy Bremer. I'm Janae Gibbs-Muir, and this is Speaking Out.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.